Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. And today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of yesterday's first public impeachment hearing from Frank Bowman, a professor of law at the University of Missouri School of Law and a former federal prosecutor, whose latest book just out is High Crimes and Misdemeanors, A History of Impeachment in the Age of Trump. He joins us to discuss the sad reality in post-truth America that it is unlikely yesterday's compelling and credible evidence from the nonpartisan witnesses will move the needle in our divided country. And although the contrast between the sober and professional chairman Adam Schiff and his Republican counterparts, who were hysterical and unhinged as they displayed their fealty to Trump while shamelessly pandering to Fox News viewers, was stark, the manic ranting from Jim Jordan and the wildly aggressive accusations by Congressman Ratcliffe and the delusional conspiracies of Devin Nunes did ensure that the unyielding support from Trump's base was not eroded. But now that Nancy Pelosi is talking about impeachment based on bribery, which is spelled out in the Constitution, we'll look into whether there will be additional articles added to the abuse of presidential power and examine whether the Democrats were successful in laying the foundation of their impeachment case, as more explosive evidence is expected to come from a witness who overheard an incriminating phone call between Ambassador Sondland and President Trump. Then we'll speak with Michael Hayden, a senior investigative reporter at the Southern Poverty Law Center, who is the author of a new report at SPLC's Hate Watch blog, Stephen Miller's Affinity for White Nationalism Revealed in Leaked Emails. He joins us to discuss the horrifying emails the now White House senior advisor shared with a reporter at Breitbart when Miller worked as an aide to Senator Jeff Sessions, in which he recommended disgustingly racist books and white supremacist websites in trying to influence Breitbart's coverage of immigration and other issues. Then finally, with yesterday's visit to the White House by Turkey's president turning surreal when Erdogan pulled out his iPad and insisted on showing Trump and the five Republican senators an anti-Kurdish propaganda video, we will analyze why a critic of Erdogan, Lindsey Graham, did a sudden turnaround to promise the autocrat he would block the House bill condemning Turkey for the Armenian genocide. Liesl Hintz, a professor of international relations at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and author of Identity Politics Inside Out, National Identity Contestation and Foreign Policy in Turkey, joins us. And joining us now is Frank Bowman, a professor of law at the University of Missouri School of Law and a former federal and state prosecutor. He's written extensively on impeachment in legal journals and the popular press, including the New York Times, Politico, and Slate, where he's a regular contributor. And he has provided testimony to both houses of Congress on multiple subjects, including the meaning of high crimes and misdemeanors during the Clinton impeachment crisis. And his latest book just out is High Crimes and Misdemeanors, A History of Impeachment for the Age of Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Bowman.
Nice to be here.
Well, thank you. And of course, the actual Constitution says, in terms of impeachment, treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors. And now bribery is actually being focused on. Nancy Pelosi referred to the evidence that happened yesterday in the first day of the public hearings on impeachment, that Trump is guilty of bribery. So that looks like it's going to be an article of impeachment.
Oh, yes. Let me put it this way. It's very clear that we will have an article of impeachment, I think, or more than one. I think it's kind of interesting that members of the House are, and indeed House leadership, are starting to talk about bribery as opposed to abuse of power, which is one of the traditional high crimes and misdemeanors for which people are traditionally impeached. I think it's largely a tactical choice. Question is whether or not explaining bribery is somehow or other simpler or thought to be simpler than high crimes and misdemeanors, which is a seemingly somewhat more abstract concept. I have some doubts about that approach, but certainly some people in the House seem to be leaning that way.
Well, of course, there are two constituencies, arguably. There's the Senate, who get to try the case, and then there's the broader public. And at this point, it's pretty clear that whatever 80, 90% of Republicans support Trump, and therefore the Republicans in the Senate are not likely to go up against their own base. So bribery may, do you think it would help the public? You know, some people are critical of the Democrats seizing on this Ukraine phone call as being the best bet to put your, all your chips on. Do you share that concern? In other words, maybe bribery is a much more publicly palatable and accessible way to understand it?
Bribery, of course, is sounds simpler, but of course, you just talked about hanging your hat, putting all your chips on the phone call. Bribery is, of course, simply a way of describing what happened with Ukraine. That's all we can really say about it. It's also an abuse of power, but some people might think it's simpler to explain. The facts, of course, are identical that would support either a claim of abuse of power or a claim of bribery. In both cases, what you're going to say is that the President of the United States invoked the vast powers of the presidency and of the United States of America to induce the president of a vulnerable country to provide information that was politically beneficial to Mr. Trump in return for the release of vital American military aid. To some extent, it doesn't matter what you call it. The facts are the same, and ultimately the same judgment's got to be made. Whether you call it bribery, whether you call it abuse of power, the question anytime you impeach a president is whether the president has engaged in behavior that is of sufficient severity that it merits his removal. So you call it bribery, that doesn't solve your problem entirely. There are certainly bribes that one could pay or one could demand that wouldn't be impeachable. If the president were accused of either accepting or paying a bribe to fix a parking ticket, it would still be bribery, but that almost certainly wouldn't be impeachable because it's just too small a thing. On the other hand, whether you call it bribery or not, using the power of the United States to convince another country to give politically desirable material, or at least the announcement of politically desirable investigations, and conditioning on that on desperately needed military aid, that's a big deal, and it doesn't really matter which category you put it in, at least to my way of thinking.
Well, the big takeaway, of course, from yesterday's first day of public hearings was the remarks by Ambassador Taylor, quoting an aide of his who was in a restaurant in Kyiv with Ambassador Gordon Sondland, Trump's political appointee as ambassador to the EU, who I think initiated a call to Trump, or maybe got a call from Trump, I'm not sure, but was talking to Donald Trump, and apparently Donald Trump was easy to overhear him. And by the way, he was speaking on an unsecure or an insecure cell phone. But nevertheless, the aide to Taylor overheard the conversation, and now he is, I think he's being deposed tomorrow or sometime soon in private, and I assume he will give public testimony. And most people seem to think that this is the closest in terms of a smoking gun, in the sense that the Republicans have been saying everything that Democrats are putting forth with these witnesses is all hearsay. But it's pretty close to firsthand knowledge, is it not, to have actually heard the president and had Gordon Sondland, when he gets off the phone, basically say Trump doesn't care about Ukraine, he only cares about getting dirt on Biden.
Well, of course, that's certainly an important additional bit of information, but there are really two things to be said about that. You talk about that as being the smoking gun. The smoking gun in this case was the initial transcript, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, everything else is really, to some extent, ancillary. There you have Trump's own words. I mean, there's no question what he meant, no question what he said. His defenders can try to argue that there's a question, but there really is no question. This is a weird reversal from, for example, the Nixon case, where there was a long, long investigation at the end of which, after lots and lots of information was built up and rocks were turned over, the last link in the chain is the so-called smoking gun tape that is finally produced after a Supreme Court opinion. But this is exactly the reverse of that. The smoking gun tape is produced as the first thing out of the box. And now all we're essentially arguing about is whether or not an obvious fact means what it obviously means. Now, you're certainly right to say that the Republicans' efforts to try to disguise that reality include saying, well, all the things that these ambassadors are saying are secondhand. We don't really know exactly what Mr. Trump said or to whom and so forth and so on. Again, we do know what he said because we know what he said to the president. But even if we were to ignore that for a moment, the strangeness of the Republicans' claim on that is pretty obvious because the answer to the complaint or the criticism that we don't know exactly what Mr. Trump said to people like Mick Mulvaney, who apparently was directly involved in withholding the aid, the answer to the reason, it's a question of why we don't know, is because Mick Mulvaney won't come down and because the president's ordered him not to.
Right.
So,
and that makes a mockery of the Republican claim that this is all hearsay because it's the White House and, by extension, the Republicans who are blocking the subpoenas.
I mean, so it's almost comical. And the fact that the Republican members of the committee are able to, you know, pronounce that argument with a straight face is really pretty surprising.
And again, I'm speaking with Frank Bowman, who's a professor of law at the University of Missouri School of Law and a former federal and state prosecutor. He's written extensively on impeachment in legal journals and the popular press, including the New York Times, Politico, and Slate, where he's a regular contributor. And he's provided testimony to both houses of Congress on multiple subjects, including the meaning of high crimes and misdemeanors during the Clinton impeachment crisis. And his latest book just out is High Crimes and Misdemeanors, A History of Impeachment for the Age of Trump. So in terms of the theatrics and with people like Jim Jordan and Devin Nunes, and sort of Devin Nunes starts out with a kind of alternative reality, and Jim Jordan, who was suddenly appointed to the Intelligence Committee in order to be, I think, the disruptor or the bomb thrower, didn't seem, even though he spoke, you know, like a machine gun, and I don't think he did much to rattle particularly these two witnesses who were pretty sober and straightforward and maintained a kind of nonpartisan dignity. What's your general impression of the way the Democrats are handling this, particularly Adam Schiff, who seems to be really a very capable person?
I think Adam Schiff is a very capable person. I think that's not only demonstrated yesterday, but he has a long and distinguished history. He's a former federal prosecutor. One thing that some people don't realize is that he actually acted as one of the House managers in a previous impeachment of a federal judge and conducted himself extremely well, by all accounts. I have that from one of his co-counsel in that case. I think he's both naturally a very capable person, and I think he's made a couple of errors, as we all do. I think the choice to somewhat exaggerate the nature of what Mr. Trump said on that call in a sarcastic way was probably an error because it gives other people an opportunity to castigate him for that. But by and large, I think he's doing an excellent job, and I think the Democrats as a group are distinguishing themselves as being, you know, sober interlocutors of some very distinguished public servants. I think, of course, other than the detail which you mentioned at the top of the interview regarding, you know, the overhearing of this conversation between Sondland and Trump, which is an interesting corroborative detail, I don't think we really learned much in these hearings that we didn't already know. What I think is distressing is the tone and the substance of the Republican response. And it contrasts dramatically with really any previous experience in American history. Certainly if you go back to the Nixon impeachment, even though there was a Republican president was being impeached, Republican legislators in both the Senate and the House conducted themselves, you know, as politicians, no doubt, but nonetheless, again, as honorable public servants who were very interested in finding out the facts. When they found them out, they sometimes certainly would argue them favorably towards President Nixon. But when it became clear that Nixon really had besmirched his office, really had gone over the line of what we're willing to permit from our presidents, Republicans stepped forward. They six of them voted for one or the other articles of impeachment in the House Judiciary Committee, and a body of them ultimately went up to the Congress, or went from Congress up to the White House, and told Nixon he needed to resign. And the contrast between that kind of, you know, honorable public spirited behavior and what we saw from at least the House Republicans in the committee couldn't be starker. These guys seem little interested, if at all, in actually determining what the facts are. They are essentially acting not as legislators trying to protect the Constitution and indeed to protect the prerogatives and the dignity of the House, but instead they're acting as Trump's criminal defense lawyers. And oftentimes pursuing lines of inquiry that are plainly not established by either by the facts or supported by logic. And I just find that deeply, deeply distressing. It's just bad for the country. It's bad for the Congress to have our legislators behaving this way. It would be fine, I think, if Republicans were to argue, as they might, that the facts are what they are, but the behavior is insufficiently grave to warrant removal of this president, or make some other intellectually defensible arguments. But they're not doing that. They're essentially creating fantasy theories, going down rabbit holes, trying to distract from the truth of what occurred. And that's very, very bad for the country. Very, very bad indeed.
So as a former federal prosecutor and an expert on impeachment, I would welcome your analysis of whether the witnesses and Schiff and the Democrats successfully laid the foundation yesterday for their case. It does seem to me that that's what the intention was.
Yes, they did. I mean, as a factual matter, I mean, if we were judging this purely as a trial in a court, I would say that the Democrats had much the better of the day. Their witnesses were, you know, obviously upright, honest public servants doing the best they could to answer questions directly, and the facts are pretty compelling, and I think we'll get more so. But of course, any impeachment is not a trial in a court. It's a political exercise. It's an exercise in persuasion, not just of the people there in the room, not just even of Congress itself, but of the larger public. And as compelling as I think the facts are, I nonetheless think that given the fractured nature of our media environment, the fractured nature of our politics, it is sadly unlikely that a large or even any significant chunk of the public that supported Mr. Trump in the first instance are likely to have their minds changed by any of this. And part of that is because, you know, if we were to reflect back to, again, the Nixon period, or even Clinton, if you'd seen the kind of, you know, evasion of facts, the kind of deflection, the kind of pursuit of conspiracy theories that were unsubstantiated by facts, if you'd seen any of that in those eras, the news media would essentially have corrected it. They would have made it functionally impossible for whichever party was trying to pursue those fantasies to sustain them. They would have been embarrassed to continue down those lines. But we don't live in that environment anymore. Both parties, frankly, have sort of media bubbles into which they can retreat when they, you know, when they escape the real world. The Republicans, perhaps even more so than the Democrats, though perhaps that's debatable. And therefore, you've got a whole ecosystem that is going to celebrate what happened yesterday as something of a success for the Republicans because they pursued, you know, the various kinds of deflections and evasions and conspiracy theories that they pursued and put those in the minds of the people that they're trying to convince, which is to say the Republican base. So I'm really fairly depressed about what happened yesterday. And it certainly was not what one would like to see as a serious exercise of constitutional democracy. But maybe it will get better.
Well, Frank Bowman, on that note, as ambivalent as it is, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Call me anytime.
I will. And again, I've been speaking with Frank Bowman, who's a professor of law at the University of Missouri School of Law and a former federal and state prosecutor. He's written extensively on impeachment in legal journals and the popular press, including the New York Times, Politico, and Slate, where he's a regular contributor. And he's provided testimony to both houses of Congress on multiple subjects, including the meaning of high crimes and misdemeanors during the Clinton impeachment crisis. And his latest book just out is High Crimes and Misdemeanors, A History of Impeachment for the Age of Trump. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. When you got nothing to prove, it's so hard. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michael Hayden, a senior investigative reporter at the Southern Poverty Law Center, a three-time grantee of the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. He has previously written for the Los Angeles Times, Newsweek, Vice, and National Geographic. And he's the author of a new report at the Southern Poverty Law Center's Hate Watch blog, Stephen Miller's Affinity for White Nationalism Revealed in Leaked Emails. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Hayden.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Thank you. And so let's talk about the leaked emails, how you got them, who they came from. And I take it they were written in the lead up to the 2016 election when White House Senior Advisor Stephen Miller was trying to promote white nationalism and extremist neo-Nazi ideas and anti-immigration rhetoric through the conservative site Breitbart.
Yeah. So Katie McHugh, who used to be an editor at Breitbart, McHugh was about 23 years old and 10 months out of college when she took the job with Breitbart. And she was told to listen to this, you know, this aide for Senator Jeff Sessions named Stephen Miller, and to hear what he had to say as far as story ideas were concerned by Breitbart editors. And McHugh worked there, you know, from 2014 to 2017, and in the, you know, and was very much in the anti-immigration movement, rubbed shoulders with overt white nationalists, and was ultimately fired from Breitbart for posting tweets that were kind of anti-Muslim in nature. And McHugh went through a personal reckoning, I guess, with her beliefs and you know, and where they led her, and what they had done to the country, and she decided that she wanted to make amends. And she reached out to me with the Stephen Miller emails, and because I had written I had done so much work reporting on extremists, exposing the identity of extremists, she said, you know, why don't you take a look at these? And when I took a look at them, you know, I had nothing, there was nothing. You know, I had no ambition of like, oh, I'm going to take on Stephen Miller or anything like that. I looked at the emails the way I would look at almost any other leaked content to me that, you know, was extremist in nature, and went from there.
So can you describe the sort of epiphany that Kate McHugh had? Was it just an act of conscience or a religious revival, or is it that relevant?
You know, I think with anybody who leaves the far right movements, there are a confluence of different factors that play. There are, you know, personal hardship as a result of the movement. I mean, I think that she certainly went through, you know, after she lost her job and, you know, she realized kind of where she was, there's that. And then there was also, you know, she came to terms with the fact that the stuff that they were doing when she was a young woman had now turned into policy and the administration. And that, I think, really, really played on her conscience.
But she actually got fired from Breitbart for being too far to the right and too much of a white nationalist, from what I take it you just told us.
Yeah, I mean, she really believed that she was a true believer, and you can see her in these emails doing that. But I think one thing that is important for people to understand about McHugh, and I really think that she did a heroic thing by turning these over, is that she did not ask us to censor her out of it. She said, these are my words, this is what I said at this time, and she did not want her picture in it. You know, she has turned down television interviews related to this, I know, and she just, you know, she was focused almost exclusively, she wanted the focus to be on Stephen Miller and how she could help tell people or tell the public, you know, what he believes when he is, you know, in private.
And, of course, on Tuesday, Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar called for Stephen Miller to step down, just quoting their statement by Omar, "This type of racism and hatred has no place in our government. Miller needs to step down now." So let's talk then about the actual content of this email exchange between Stephen Miller and this young woman working for Breitbart.
Yeah.
Which was the... Which was the worst? Which is the one that really got your attention?
You know, if you think of that, you know, you know, spent some time myself and a researcher who is anonymous with Southern Poverty Law Center. We went through these emails so many times, and really long hours and weekends going through it, deciphering what was being talked about at a particular time. And then when we assembled this and you know, when I reported it, you know, I kind of put it together and put it like sort of like where the you know, the kind of the most flashy things were up top, you know, where you have at the beginning these shares from the website BDAIR, which is a white genocide, white nationalist focused website. He shares Camp of the Saints, which is a virulently racist novel, which is popular with white nationalists and neo-Nazis. He shares, you know, with her from, you know, American Renaissance, which is also a, you know, very popular white supremacist thing. But the most important one for me is buried closer to the back, which is his praise for Calvin Coolidge, which you might say like, oh, well, you know, whatever, he's a president or whatever. But what he's really talking about there, and Calvin Coolidge, you see him praised frequently on white nationalist sites. What he is talking about is Calvin Coolidge's signed into law the 1924 Immigration Act. And the 1924 Immigration Act was based around eugenics, full stop, race science, and had racial quota laws, you know, forbidding certain countries from, you know, certain people from coming to the U.S. from certain countries. And that is scary because we did away with that in 1965 with Hart Celler. And you see, you know, in these emails, Miller refers to that period from 1924 to 1965 as our heritage, the heritage of Calvin Coolidge. And if that's the heritage we're going back to, if that's what Make America Great Again means, it is an extraordinarily scary proposition, particularly for people of color.
And again, I speak with Michael Hayden, a senior investigative reporter at the Southern Poverty Law Center, a three-time grantee of the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. He's previously written for the Los Angeles Times, Newsweek, Vice, and National Geographic. And he's the author of the new report at the Southern Poverty Law Center's Hate Watch blog, Stephen Miller's Affinity for White Nationalism Revealed in Leaked Emails. Well, it looks as though Stephen Miller, who's been driving the immigration policy, has actually achieved quite a bit in terms of rolling back the reforms that came out in the 60s of Calvin Coolidge's eugenics-based immigration policy, where, you know, the president talks about we need people from Norway, not from these S-hole countries.
Yeah. It's funny that you have to censor yourself and the president can't or doesn't. But, you know, what I hope that this does is wake up people and show them where a lot of this stuff is coming from. And you know what is extremely scary is that you have people, you know, in the anti-immigration far right who are complaining about Stephen Miller not being strong enough and complaining that Trump is not strong enough. And it's one of those things where you give up, you know, a few inches and they want, you know, a few yards, and then they want more. And yeah, I mean, I look, when we were going through these emails, I felt, as an American, ashamed of the place that we were in to have somebody writing policies like this and speaking in the manner that he did.
Well, didn't some of the far-right people heckle Donald Jr., who's out promoting his book?
Yeah, they did. I think there's a lot of, you know, because I monitor extremist settling, a lot of that is performance in order to try to get their point of, you know, to promote their extreme point of view and get themselves talked about in the way that they do. But also, yeah, imagine a situation in which you have someone who reads, you know, apparently reads VDare, American Renaissance, and InfoWars, writing policy in the White House, and the base wants more. I mean, they want more than that. And that should give, you know, wake people up to the just how, you know, how apparently radicalized Trump's base has become in some ways. Not all of it. Certainly, there are many Republicans who probably do not agree with the people in those crowds, but there are enough of them that it should be unsettling to people, I think.
So, and of course, this book that you talked about that Miller was promoting in his emails to Kate McHugh back in 2015, The Camp of the Saints, that was also a book that Stephen Bannon had already recommended too, wasn't he?
Well, so Bannon, when Bannon was eventually sort of forced out of the White House, that came in August of 2017, immediately after Charlottesville took place, the Unite the Right rally. And prior to that, a big scandal started to brew as people began to realize the times that Bannon had promoted Camp of the Saints. But what's interesting about the timing of Bannon promoting it, the first time I've ever seen Bannon promoted in public was on Breitbart Radio on Sirius XM. He did a show, and he mentioned it while he was interviewing who but Jeff Sessions, who was Miller's boss at the time. And the reason why that October 2015 date matters is because in these emails, 1 month earlier, we see Stephen Miller promoting Camp of the Saints to Breitbart staffers. And then, 3 weeks later, what happens? Julia Hahn writes a story about for Breitbart about the very thing that Miller asked her to do. And then 1 week later, boom, Steve Bannon mentions it. So there's a question of whether Miller was, to what degree Miller was influencing, other people like Bannon, their extremism, how influential was Miller in this regard. Camp of the Saints, just to explain to your audience, is a virulently racist book in which Indian people are depicted as, as eating feces and seeking to rape white women, and they basically overtake France and basically destroy it from within. And, this is a dystopian novel that is very popular with neo-Nazis and white nationalists. And the average person who would pick it up and read it for a second would be so disgusted that they would throw it out the window, I believe. So this is not the type of thing you put on your bookshelf unless you study extremism or you are an extremist.
So you mentioned Jeff Sessions, who Stephen Miller worked for before coming to the White House. And now, of course, he's one of Trump's longest serving aides, along with Kellyanne Conway and Jared and Ivanka. So he's really well ensconced, as we know, his former boss is person non grata with Trump. And now Jeff Sessions running for his old Senate seat in Alabama, and Trump, of course, is dissing him. What do you think is going to happen down there? I know it's not necessarily part of your expertise, but you're in Alabama, aren't you, Montgomery?
Yeah, well, the center is. We have satellites, in the South. What I was going to say is that, about that is I don't know, but I do know that local political reporters have been asking us questions about these emails, and I would be very interested to see to what degree Sessions' office and the role that they played in these emails begin to become a local issue for him.
So is there any understanding on the part of people like Stephen Miller about who they're supporting? I mean, didn't they notice what was happening at Charlottesville? Or did they endorse what's happening at Charlottesville? Or indeed, was it Stephen Miller that got President Trump to say there were good people on both sides? Because obviously the neo-Nazis are people on Miller's side, or at least the side that he has sympathy for.
Yeah, absolutely right, in the sense that they are politically on the same side as him. What I would say is we don't know because we don't have any of his private correspondences from that time. But we do know one thing from the emails that is very important to stress, which is the fact that Miller was aggressively trying to push stories in support of maintaining Confederate monuments, keeping them up, basically stories attacking opponents of Confederate monuments, people who wanted to remove them. So, and we also know he's very influential on Trump, in terms of his, what he says in speeches. So, I mean, you can read between the lines there and wonder to what Miller might have been telling him from behind the scenes about how to handle that situation.
Well, Michael Hayden, I thank you for bringing this story to light.
I guess by extension,
I should thank Kate McHugh, right?
Yes, really. I can't stress enough that McHugh, really did a brave thing. She really did. And she did it in the right way. She didn't try to make it about her.
Well, again, I've been speaking with Michael Hayden, a senior investigative reporter at the Southern Poverty Law Center, a three-time grantee of the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. He has previously written for the Los Angeles Times, Newsweek, Vice, and National Geographic, and he's the author of the new report at the Southern Poverty Law Center's Hate Watch blog, Stephen Miller's Affinity for White Nationalism Revealed in Leaked Emails. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Liesl Hintz, who is a professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, who studies the intersection of identity politics and foreign policy with a focus on Turkey and the Greater Middle East. Her latest book is Identity Politics Inside Out, National Identity Contestation and Foreign Policy in Turkey. Welcome to Background Briefing, Liesl Hintz.
Thanks very much for having me.
And the visit to the White House by President Erdogan of Turkey was obviously overshadowed by the first day of public hearings in the impeachment of Donald Trump, who, of course, was hosting his friend. He makes no bones about the fact that he considers Erdogan a friend. But apparently the meeting at which five U.S. senators, I think most of whom, if not all of whom, have been critical of Turkey's invasion of the north of Syria, Erdogan whipped out an iPad and showed them this peculiar propaganda film that was apparently virulently anti-Kurdish and it doesn't seem like it was very persuasive. Since you've studied the politics of Turkey and Erdogan in particular, my understanding is he used to be, when he started out years back, he was actually quite sympathetic to the Kurds and progressive in trying to deal with them. But now he seems to have a huge animus. Is it politically convenient, or do you think it's heartfelt?
So that's an important question. You know, when his ruling party, the Justice and Development Party, comes into power in 2002, basically an identity red line against any sort of public or political recognition of Kurdish identity dissolves. For Erdogan and his supporters, members of his party, their understanding of what it means to be Turkish has to do with being a pious Sunni Muslim rather than previous understandings of Turkish identity that had to do with loving Mustafa Kemal Atatürk and respecting the military and being a secular, supporting a secular society, and also having a sort of homogenous, linguistic, territorial-based understanding of Turkish identity. So that meant that the expression of Kurdish identity was dangerous. It must be inherently separatist. That was previous understandings of identity. With the AKP, you sort of have the opening of the conditions of possibility for recognizing Kurds, for outreaches to them. As you said, under Erdogan's rule, the AKP has made numerous outreaches to Kurds. However, even though that identity red line has been removed, I wouldn't say that Erdogan had any particular empathy for Kurds. He was happy to the extent that pious Sunni Kurds would vote for the AKP, and he didn't have any kind of pre-existing fear of their identity expression. But when we see the government actually engaging in negotiations with the Kurdistan Workers Party, the PKK, that's when Erdogan needs their support for his project, that is, to transform Turkey from a parliamentary system into a presidential one. So it really was sort of a politically motivated set of outreaches to the Kurds that basically led to sort of an unprecedented ceasefire agreement. And the way that we can see that it was politically motivated is as soon as Kurds withdraw their support for that presidential project and they become a political threat in elections, taking away the AKP's parliamentary majority for the first time, that's when the AKP switches on them. So there's a very political understanding, a political motivation behind either recognition or sort of targeting of aggression towards Kurds.
So the animus to the PKK in trying to tar the Syrian Kurds with the same brush, calling them terrorists, and the video that apparently showed was all about our war against the terrorists in Syria. Öcalan, the leader of the PKK, has been in Turkish custody for some time. Is it really a real threat, or is it just a convenient boogeyman for Erdogan?
So obviously the answer is it's both, right? Because it's complicated. So the Kurdistan Workers Party, the PKK, is recognized as a terrorist group by the U.S., the EU, and Turkey. The YPG, basically it's sort of sister or brother organization, there are close links between the two, is the People's Protection Units, that is the Syrian Kurdish forces, which is not recognized as a terrorist group by the U.S. What the U.S. tried to do in fighting the war against ISIS or the Islamic State was create this overarching entity, the Syrian Democratic Forces, of which the Syrian Kurdish YPG was a main fighting and institutional component. So there is a legitimate perception of a security threat from Turkey's point of view when it comes to the YPG because it is linked to the PKK, because the PKK has carried out attacks against both security installations and civilians within Turkey. However, it's also important to understand the domestic politics of these campaigns. You know, Erdogan is struggling to maintain the 50% voter support that he needs to continue to remain president. Although we don't have elections for a few years, polls are showing that he's really hovering around 48%. And in fact, that 48% recognizes a couple of bumps in the polls that he received following this Turkish military campaign in Syria. What it does is it unites an otherwise sort of fragmented opposition to his party. So not only does he get a lot of support from his own party and from the ultra-nationalist and very anti-Kurdish Nationalist Action Party, which is its coalition partner, but you also get support for this campaign amongst, you know, secular nationalists or ethnic nationalists, people who wouldn't necessarily vote for the AKP. The polls are showing around 80-85% support among Turks polled, Turkish citizens polled, for the campaign. So he definitely gets a domestic political boost from this as well.
And again, I'm speaking with Liesl Hintz, who's a professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, who studies the intersection of identity politics and foreign policy with a focus on Turkey and the greater Middle East. Her latest book is Identity Politics Inside Out, National Identity Contestation and Foreign Policy in Turkey. So if he's had a bump in the polls because of the war, and of course, you know, we recall the Iraq War, George W. Bush and Cheney, et cetera, were all riding high until it all turned sour. Is it likely to turn sour for him? Not necessarily in the short run, but in the long run? It's never been particularly practical, the idea that he could resettle 3 million largely urban Syrian Arabs in the Turkish lands in that buffer state. They're not farmers. They're not, you know, they're all from the cities, et cetera. Do you think that there will be a growing backlash, or will the jingoism continue?
So I think this is an important question in the sense of what are Turkey's real long-term interests in Syria. I think you're right to point out that, you know, in addition to pushing back what they consider to be a security threat, these Kurdish YPG forces clearing that area, you know, very much to be able to essentially, you know, return or deposit these Syrians who sought refuge in Turkey. And that has a domestic political component as well, because although Erdogan initially welcomed those who were fleeing Bashar al-Assad's violence in Syria as, you know, Sunni brothers and open arms and open borders and all that, you know, the conflict was protracted and they weren't going anywhere and they looked as though they were going to settle in Turkey. And he's looking at opinion polls and he's seeing that even his own supporters are frustrated with the fact that there are nearly 4 million Syrians in Turkey at this point. So he needs to carve out a place to be able to deposit them. In terms of, you know, whether or not this is going to hurt him in the long run, I think one of the sort of ironic aspects of that is that the U.S. Sort of almost paved the way for Erdogan to be able to clear out that area without a protracted campaign. So the fact that, you know, Trump seems to give a green light to the Turkish action in northern Syria over the phone in early October. And then, of course, you see a lot of pushback, as you said earlier, you know, from senators, from Congress saying, absolutely not, this is the wrong decision. We shouldn't have abandoned our Kurdish allies. We don't want Turkey to engage in violence against them. You then have this U.S. delegation led by Vice President Mike Pence, ostensibly meant to kind of give a stern warning to Erdogan about Turkey's actions in northern Syria, but they end up with this sort of, you know, cessation of hostilities agreement. And 5 days later, Erdogan's gone to Moscow to get Russian troops to help patrol the area with him. So, you know, that could have been a protracted conflict. There could have been even more atrocities that we saw. One of the things that we know is that we have evidence that the Turkish-backed Syrian forces that formerly were sort of, you know, part of the Syrian Free Army, now they're sort of organized in the Syrian National Army, but they were carrying out atrocities against some of these Kurdish civilians as well. So that could have really hurt him domestically, the fact that, you know, Turkey's allying with these forces who are clearly committing what some have called need to be deemed war crimes. But he sort of gets these conditions whereby the military doesn't have to engage in those kinds of activities. So in a sense, he was saved from any kind of protracted war that could have lost him a lot of support in the polls.
Well, the SDF, though, the Syrian Democratic Forces, even though the YPG is a big component, it's pretty diverse. Lots of Arabs, even Turkmen in it. And what is the animus, though? Because the Kurds have been a beleaguered people. They've been sold out on a number of occasions by Henry Kissinger and Nixon some time back, and again by Donald Trump. Is there something more that I'm not getting here, Liesl, about the animist, I mean, labeling them terrorists, etc.? Is it the fact that they're sort of socialists? I mean, the U.S. Military is particularly fond of them because they did the heavy lifting. They did all the fighting, and they had 11,000 dead and 22,000 wounded.
Absolutely. And I think it is important to recognize the multi-ethnic component of the SDF. But the SDF was put together by the United States so that it could say it wasn't arming a group that Turkey considers a terrorist organization. So it was an artificial construct, in a sense. And it was meant to eventually become a multi-ethnic fighting force, but it was really trying to get around what I think the U.S. correctly, if not to the necessary extent, anticipated Turkey's objections to the fact that they were relying on the YPG fighters to sort of topple the or crush the Islamic State. So, you know, in terms of Turkey's animus towards the SDF, I don't think it has anything to do with its particular ideological or political organization. I think it does have to do with the fact that they see, you know, the SDF sort of as equivalent to the YPG, equivalent to the PYD, which is the sort of political union of the Syrian Kurds, of those Syrian Kurds. And they're using this sort of very wide terrorist brush, you know, obviously not just in foreign policy, but domestically, right? So if you're reporting on the conflict, you're a terrorist. If you are a supporter of the People's Democratic Party, you're a terrorist. So that language is extraordinarily powerful in Turkey, and it's wielded to be able to combat any kind of potential opposition. So I think that's really what's driving it here.
So the meeting, of course, at the White House, where the senators were, Erdogan whipped out his iPad and showed them this peculiar propaganda film, this very anti-Kurdish propaganda film, which didn't work. I don't know whether it would work in Turkey. Presumably it does. It certainly appears to work for Erdogan. He also returned Trump's letter saying, don't be a fool, which we'd previously been reported that he tossed it in the trash.
Right.
But
right.
I guess he must have taken it out of the trash. That was obviously a way to tell Trump that he wasn't too happy about it.
Absolutely.
But they are supposedly friends. There was a piece in the New York Times showing the two leaders with their respective sons-in-laws, Jared Kushner and the son-in-law of Erdogan, who runs his business, And the implication in that story was that these two guys, their sons-in-laws, work in the back room to make the deals.
Sure.
And that there's a peculiar symmetry there, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. You know, I thought that piece was really insightful in terms of identifying the dynamics of how, frankly, in Trump's mind, deals get done. You know, we know that Erdogan has been trying to sort of prime his son-in-law, Berat Albayrak, who is also the Minister of Treasury and Finance, possibly to be his successor. He sits next to him. You know, he goes on all these foreign policy delegations. He hasn't been extremely successful in terms of projecting any kind of confident ability to control the economy. But he does seem as though he's, you know, Erdogan is trying to create a space for him potentially as a successor. And, you know, I think you do see a sort of son-in-law-ization of politics, that they're able to, being from the same generation and sort of being given the same privileges, that they were able to have these conversations that, you know, these formal diplomatic people in these formal diplomatic positions of power aren't able to have. So I do think that's a really important component of that.
So what did you make of the remarks that John Bolton made at a private function? I think it was a bunch of Wall Streeters. He was apparently paid a pretty handsome fee. And he said, apparently, that in the course of Q&A, that he was mystified as to why Trump decided to suddenly give the green light to Erdogan to invade the north of Syria and to withdraw the U.S. troops and to essentially create the vacuum which Turkey quickly filled, essentially selling out the Kurds. And he said all the national security people in the government also are mystified by it, and that he felt that the only explanation had to be something personal between Trump and Erdogan, possibly to do with business interests. So what we know, there are what, twin towers there?
Mm-hmm. What's, the Trump Towers, right?
Trump Towers in Istanbul, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is going on there in terms of business interests?
Well, I appreciate that we now have a lot of individuals who are coming out of the Trump administration, and some are more forthcoming than others in terms of the criticisms and insinuations that they're able to make. In terms of that being the only reason why Trump switched his policy, I don't think so. I think that he found the prospect of being able to tell the U.S. public that he's bringing the troops home in sort of conjunction with his desire to so-called end endless wars. You know, I think that was attractive to him. And the fact that Erdogan seemed to indicate that he could kind of take over the burden of ISIS. So I think that was attractive. But I do think there's something to be said for the idea that Trump's personal financial interests drive a lot of his foreign policy. In fact, we see almost a similar, even to bring the son-in-law dynamic back into it, you know, it's not technically son-in-law, but it's similar generation, Jared Kushner's interactions with Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, and the fact that during the Khashoggi incident, when Jamal Khashoggi was executed, essentially, in the Saudi consulate in Turkey, that, you know, you have a U.S. that is very hesitant to condemn or criticize or investigate anything having to do with it. Now, the arguments that Trump was making had to do with defense contracts and sort of U.S. interests related to finance. But I think that there is a personal financial stake in there as well, in the Saudi case, in the Turkey case, and in others.
Well, of course, there's been reports that the Qataris, who have a confrontation with Saudi Arabia, have apparently fairly sophisticated signals intelligence operations, and that they tapped Mohammed bin Salman's cell phone and captured a number of conversations that he had with Jared Kushner. And I think it was on WhatsApp, as a matter of fact. And that because of Qatar's close relationship with Turkey, who are essentially their security guarantor against a Saudi invasion, those tapes ended up with Erdogan. Had you heard anything about that?
I haven't heard anything about that, but it is, I think, important to recognize, you know, Turkey at this point has very, very few allies in its region, despite its, you know, sort of desire to have zero problems in the neighborhood and to be this Sunni Muslim leader in the region. Turkey's only real, you know, state ally is Qatar. And Turkey very much was the security guarantor, you know, sending aid to Qatar when the Gulf Cooperation Council, led by Saudi, was carrying out this blockade against it. You know, Qatar and Turkey fall down on the same side within the Middle East in terms of some of the actors that they support or are ideologically aligned with, in terms of Hamas, in terms of the Muslim Brotherhood, and that's something on which they're at the opposite, they're on the opposite side of Saudi. So that was actually fascinating to see sort of play out during the Khashoggi discussions, was how direct, how open was Turkey going to confront Saudi, since they are rivalries. They do have a rivalry for being the sort of Sunni leader in the region, but that there are these and of course there is construction interests and financial interests and other aspects. But to what extent are they going to come to a head over a confrontation? So I don't have any information on that, but it's a fascinating subject, and it wouldn't necessarily surprise me. And again, it demonstrates that sort of, son-in-law or younger generation who's not the head of state or, in the position of political power, wielding quite a lot of influence.
Well, Liesl Hintze, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's always a pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Liesl Hintze, who's a professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, who studies the intersection of identity politics and foreign policy with a focus on Turkey and the greater Middle East. And her latest book is Identity Politics Inside Out, National Identity Contestation and Foreign Policy in Turkey. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.